This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Our topic today, the retirement plan of last resort. We're going to be talking about financial goal setting, and we're going to cover the topic of reverse mortgages for those who either didn't plan or find themselves in a very difficult financial situation.
Jim, before we get started today, I just want to tie this topic in with what we talked about last week. Last week, we talked about long-term care and the cost of long-term care. We talked about ways to fund it. We talked about either self-insuring by saving enough or starting a specific type of annuity. We talked about long-term care insurance. We also mentioned very briefly at the end of last week's program that reverse mortgages might be a way to fund your costs for long-term care if you hadn't planned ahead. So, Jim, could you describe a little bit more other reasons why someone might need to dip into their home for equity?
Well, you know, there are a number of reasons why people might either get into, let's say, their home equity, borrow against it. But, Kathleen, there's a couple of reasons. Number one, they planned and they saved for their retirement, but the returns weren't sufficient. In other words, they didn't accumulate the amount of assets they thought they were going to have when they retired. So that's a big factor. And I mean, you know, you just take a look at the interest rate market today, where you're looking at 0% interest rates on money market funds. You know, 2-year treasury notes, Kathleen, are paying 0.25%. Think about that for a minute. 5 years ago, you would have got 5%. So we've seen almost a 95% drop in the rates of return earned on interest income. And a lot of people, when they get to their retirement years, they've accumulated an amount of assets. They're saying, you know what? This is all I've got to live on. I don't want to take any risks. So they get very conservative. They go into either fixed income. Maybe they're putting money in the bank. Well, guess what? Those rates of return don't work in an era of financial repression, where we now have central banks that are artificially suppressing the interest rates. So let's put it this way. Let's say that you managed to accumulate $1 million. I mean, $1 million for most people, there's not too many people that have $1 million.
It sounds like a lot of money to me.
Yeah, it's a lot of money to most people. But Kathleen, if you were to put that into a 10-year treasury note today, you would only get $20,000. Go back, let's say, to the year 2000, you could have got $80,000 on a 10-year treasury note, or go back to the year 1990, you would have got $100,000. You know, so we've seen the interest rates come down from 10% down to 8% down to 5% in 2008. Now they're down to 0.25%. So a second reason is the rate of return has not been sufficient. And then another one is maybe people planned and saved, but all of a sudden there's an unexpected big expense of medical costs. I know we run across this a lot when we do retirement planning. That's why we try to run medical profiles. But people are saying, okay, this is what my essential budget is. This is kind of what I call the bucket list, the things I wish to have. All of that's fine and dandy. But what happens 10, 15 years into retirement? There's a serious illness, maybe not fully covered by Medicare or Medicare insurance, or extended care, which is what we talked about last week. One spouse gets dementia, gets Alzheimer's, and all of a sudden, instead of the expenses of running one household, now you have the expenses of running two households. Even though it may only last 3 or 4 years, nonetheless, running two households is something that a lot of couples didn't plan on. And then I think maybe the last one is you just simply had people that did not plan. and save, and there's a couple mistakes they made along the way in terms of not saving, putting money aside, utilizing employer pension plans like 401k with matching contributions, or maybe there was a period of extended unemployment between one spouse. You know, Kathleen, there's a number of reasons out there, but I would say poor returns, unexpected expenses in three, they didn't plan and save.
Jim, I want to start talking a little bit about this last one you just mentioned about not saving enough. I've been doing some reading on people's retirement plan savings or retirement savings, and I was pretty shocked to find out that almost half of people over 55 years old don't even have $50,000 saved for retirement. That's pretty scary.
Well, I mean, you take a look at the cost of living today, Kathleen. You take a family today, it takes almost two households to pay the bill, or two income earners in a household. Mom went to work in the 70s, and that's just a fact of life. You know, you take a look at the cost of educating children today, putting them through college. College has gotten a lot more expensive. And let's face it, the day-to-day expenses of living keep going up every single year. And it's not like if you're in an employment situation, you can go to your boss and say, you know what, they just raised gas prices, my utility bills are up. You know, I'm looking at my cost of living, it's probably up about 10%. Given my tax rate, you know, boss, I need a 15% pay hike. That's not the way the world's working today.
I'm glad you mentioned about compensation from your employer, because the other statistic I was also shocked to learn is that nearly half of the population is not making use of retirement programs, whether it's 401ks or IRAs. That's a pretty big oversight on their part, and for two reasons. Number one, making use of employer matching, and number two, the tax benefits of putting money away in these tax-deferred programs.
You know, I think there's a partial explanation for that, Kathleen. Part of it may be that expenses are so tight that they don't have the money, or they need every dollar that they get to live on. That may be one, inflation eroding the purchasing power of their income. And then secondly, you know, when you think about retirement, you think of a young couple, or even say somebody out of college or starting fresh in their career, they're thinking, okay, I'm in my 20s, retirement, oh my goodness, that's something 30, 40 years from now. And then another situation is you get couples that start out and, you know, they get married. And one of the things that we've talked about in previous programs is there's always competition for money. For a young couple starting out in life, it may be saving enough money for that down payment on that first house may be a priority. Secondly, it may be putting money aside for a child's education, maybe weddings, bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs. All those kind of things take priority. And what I think makes for a successful long-term plan is you prioritize those. So let's say that you're starting out in life, you just got married. At the top of the list is the down payment for the home. So that's priority number one. Priority two, you're starting a family, you want to put some money aside for your kids' education. And then maybe three is retirement. So what you do, Kathleen, is you prioritize those. And once one goal is met, let's say you accumulate enough savings for a down payment on a home, you get into the house, okay, that checklist comes off the list, and then all of a sudden the other things move up, and then you start contributing in retirement. And we'll get to this in a second, but when it comes to planning for college education, boy, I see some big mistakes that are made in planning, especially for couples that are only 10, 15 years away from retirement. And then I think the third factor is not fully understanding the wonders of compound interest. I mean, let's put it this way. You know, a lot of employer plans where you're allowed to put money in a 401k plan, there's matching contributions so you have a nice return. Let's say your employer matches your contributions by 50% or 100%. I mean, that's a 50 or 100% return on the first year of your contribution. And I think that what they don't understand is over long periods of time, compounding works in your favor and can build significant amounts of capital for retirement. So I think it's ignorance of how compounding works, because the earlier you start, the longer you have to compound your wealth, the more money you're going to have at retirement.
I think that's a really good point, Jim. I think a lot of people, especially young people, don't always understand the power of saving a little bit now versus saving a lot more later. You know, for every dollar you put away now, it's almost equivalent to putting away $10 later. I wanted to circle back to your prioritization for the young couple, because that's sort of where I am at in life. You know, you mentioned the home first and then college and maybe retirement. I just want to make sure that our listeners are clear that the prioritization of those three items is completely couple-specific and family-specific. For some couples, it might be more important for them to save for their own retirement first and then worry about the home and the kids. So a lot of this whole idea of prioritizing where your money's going is going to be very dependent on your own situation with your family and what your own family priorities are.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, for most couples, there's something, Kath and I call immediate gratification. Let's say you're a young couple, you're 25 years old, you're thinking, boy, wouldn't it be nice to move out of the apartment, to have our own place, to start a family? And you're thinking, that's immediate. That's something I can see. It's visible. It's in front of me. You know, I can look at a house.
It's tangible. Yeah.
Yeah. It's something you can visualize and see. You know, talking about retirement when you're age 25, about something that may happen 40 years from now, you know, most people just don't have the foresight to think that far down the road. But that's the key. The sooner that you begin to think about it, the better off you're going to be.
And I also think, Jim, a lot of people seem to have this mistaken notion that somehow Social Security is going to cover the majority of their retirement expenses. And I think this is pretty much a fundamental misunderstanding of the original purpose of Social Security itself. It wasn't meant to replace people's primary source of retirement savings. It was meant to be a supplement to their retirement savings. So I think, again, this whole idea of people that haven't planned and saved, I think part of it may also be due to just a fundamental misunderstanding of government-supplied, quote-unquote, retirement plans like Social Security.
Well, it certainly was designed originally as some sort of supplemental income. But the problem that we're having right now is, you're right, Kathleen, a lot of people are counting on that. As you mentioned, a vast majority of Americans have less than $55,000 saved for retirement. So outside any kind of pension that they may get from either an employer, if they worked in the private sector, or 401k if they had one, or let's say if they work for government, well, they usually don't run into that problem because governments usually provide their employees with some kind of defined benefit pension plan. But you're right. Social Security was meant to be a supplemental form of income. And one thing that I think that we're seeing that is becoming a reality as a result of inflation, as a result of low rates of return, as a result of not enough savings is, you know what I think, and it can also be healthy as well, because a lot of doctors will tell you this, is, you know, we have clients, I have a doctor that has a substantial portfolio, but he elected to work part-time because he likes it, keeps his mind active. And I think in the new reality that we live in today, with costs going up, wages not keeping up with inflation, artificially suppressed interest rates, low rates of return on investments, I think one thing that is going to be part of the retirement picture moving forward and play a greater role is some form of part-time employment. And it may not be all that negative. It may be that you spend most of your life in one particular career, and then when you retire, you pick up another profession. Maybe you do something that you always wanted to do, weren't able to do during your working career, but it doesn't have to be all that bad. You know, working part-time, quite honestly, I don't know, maybe I came up in that generation. I've always worked since I was in second grade. I can't imagine myself not working. I don't know what I would do. I couldn't play golf.
None of the rest of us at PFS Group can even imagine you retire, Jim. It just, the mind boggles thinking about you being retired. It just is really hard to picture. I wanted to circle back a little bit about, we sort of started off the conversation talking about why reverse mortgages come into play. We've sort of touched a little bit on people maybe not planning and saving enough and the various reasons why they do that. Let's transition just a little bit and talk about maybe people who planned and saved but had unexpected medical expenses or other big costs. I was just thinking about some of our clients that have had some unexpected situations happen in their families, some health-related, some not. What I was thinking about is we've had an awful lot of boomerang parents moving back in with the kids who need to have special care or financial assistance from their children, or the opposite, boomerang kids moving back in with the parents or needing financial assistance from parents. So part of this, too, is that you did a really good plan, but like you said, the economy change, situations change, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation where someone that you love needs financial help from you, and you find your financial plan and your retirement plan suddenly in disarray because of these unexpected situations that come up.
Well, you know, life is full of surprises, and when you least expect it, they surface all the time, whether it's long-term care for parents. We have several clients right now who are taking care of their parents or providing for them because they just didn't have enough money. Either they're on fixed income and inflation has eroded it, or they didn't have the savings they thought. Or a lot of parents where the kids come back and say, you know, I lost my job. Or you see situations where you have split families today. There's divorces, single parents. So that is a new reality that you have to cope with. But the one thing that you need to keep in mind, whether it's planning for your children's education, whether it's taking care of parents, never allow that to jeopardize your own retirement. Because let's face it, the only one that's going to take care of you in retirement that you can really count on is yourself. And you don't want to get yourself in a situation and say, well, you know, we're living well now, and if things get bad, well, my kids will take care of me. Or if you're the kid, you're saying, well, I could always move back with mom and dad. And you always want to have a plan for contingencies. It's why people keep cash reserves. It's why you want to have some kind of plan that allows for these things, because they do surface, especially if you have children. We talked about illnesses. There's always something that crops up that you don't expect. And that's why I think the more that you're better prepared, having a plan, having a contingency backup, then when that unexpected event surfaces, you can say to yourself, okay, we got plan B, we know what to do.
Well, Jim, I was thinking, you know, you were mentioning about relying on yourself first. And so why don't we talk a little bit about ways that people who have planned well might find themselves in a situation where, even though their plan was great, maybe they didn't have some of these unexpected things happen, but maybe they started to make some investment choices with their plan that weren't so wise. I know over the weekend you talked a lot about some of the game-changing things that are happening. You talked about some of the different types of choices investors make with their money that maybe aren't so wise. Could you walk us through a couple of boo-boos that people might be making with their really a retirement plan that's on track, except for the investment choices being made?
Well, I think, Kathleen, first of all, the investment environment is always changing. I mean, we had a nice period between the 80s and 90s. Everything was rosy. We had pro-growth policies in Washington, whether it was in the Reagan administration or also in the Clinton administration. And so it was pretty much given. Things were pretty static. The economy was growing. The markets were going. Interest rates were much higher. And then all of a sudden that environment changed. We had a shift coming out of the 2000 tech bubble. We had our first significant bear market in nearly two decades, where the S&P lost over 40%. That was followed by some of the most unusually low interest rates we had seen in nearly three decades. And that led to the housing boom, which was the next financial crisis, with another 40% drop in the market. And so what happens is people have become conditioned by that. And they don't understand that we live in a market now that is much more driven by government policy, government intervention, either in the form of regulation, taxation, central bank intervention in the form of suppressing interest rates through a policy of financial repression. So the environment has changed. And what people tend to do is they develop this mindset, and they either fall into, gee, happy days are here again, and they're putting everything into the market. Or the other side, it's what I call the gloom and doom. And I'm in the bunker, and I've been in this bunker for 5 or 6 years. And they don't understand the impact of monetary policy that we're seeing being implemented globally, and how this money is going to find an outlet somewhere. It's going to go. And so time after time, we've had people on the show. We've had emails. We've had queue line calls expecting the worst. And, you know, we do get a crisis, whether it's Europe, whether it's Greece, whether it's a slowdown in the China economy, whether it's the debt ceiling debate, the fiscal cliff. Now the next one on the agenda is sequestration. And then what happens is that particular crisis is resolved and money is created. What happens is the market powers itself up. And so instead of looking at what the market is saying, how the market is working, people try to define what the market should be doing rather than analyze what the market is doing. And so as a result, they take the wrong investment positions, or even worse, they'll put all their money in one basket and say, okay, I found the solution. It's kind of like going to the doctor, and I use this analogy, but it's so applicable here to the investment markets. You go to the doctor, you're not feeling well, you get a physical, the doctor finds out you have blocked arteries, you have high cholesterol, and the doctor says, you're going to have to change your lifestyle. You're going to have to change your diet. You're going to have to start exercising. You're going to have to reduce stress in your life. I remember a doctor a couple of years ago, a good friend of mine, and I was actually surprised at the amount of statistics and the amount of open heart surgery and bypass surgery that we see today. And he said, you know what happens is people will make those New Year's resolutions, but as we get older, those resolutions fade. And then what ends up happening, they either get their life in shape, exercise, get their weight down and correct preemptively the medical problems they could have in the future, or they wait for a crisis, a heart attack, a stroke, clogged arteries, something like that. And many times, Kathleen, what they're looking for is a pill. And I think a lot of times that's what investors are looking for. The world is more complex. It's more complicated today. And it's like, is there a pill I can take? Oh, if you're in gloom and doom, I'll put all my money in gold. Or conversely, I'll put all my money in bonds because stocks aren't working well and interest rates are at zero, rather than a more balanced approach, you know, maybe a partial bond portfolio, maybe blue chip stocks, and maybe modifying that as you age or the markets change. So I think that's probably one of the biggest mistakes that we see made today in investment planning.
So I think one of the things that I've noticed with people I've talked to a lot recently, Jim, is we certainly have a lot of listeners and people we work with who are very scared of a market correction, which I completely understand. But they've got most of their money in cash sitting on the sidelines. And I think this kind of points out some of these investment boo-boos that can be made by people who, while they've planned well and they have a good amount of savings, we find people who either take too little risk, like being in cash completely or nearly completely in cash, or who take too much risk. And what I think is interesting is that when you're talking about staying ahead of inflation and planning for retirement, sometimes taking too little risk is just as much of a bad choice as taking too much risk. So I think that some of these things you're talking about, Jim, are very applicable to people who are trying to fund retirement.
So in summary, Kathleen, we talked about this, the plan of last resort, and we're going to talk about an option if you're down to that last resort. One of the reasons you get to that last resort is, number one, planned and saved, but the returns that you earned on your investments weren't sufficient to maybe meet your retirement goals. The second one is you planned and saved, but all of a sudden there were those unexpected big expenses, especially when it comes to medical cost. Or even third, you didn't plan and save at all. And so don't find yourself in that situation. And I don't care whatever age you are, you're never too late to start saving. Begin a program. Maybe you need to modify what you're doing now. Maybe you get a part-time job. But let's put it this way. Have yourself a plan so you don't find yourself dealing with crises, or find yourself or your life going from crises to crises. It's not a good situation to be in. It always begins with a plan, and it'll serve you well.
Jim, thanks so much for your thoughts about ways to avoid the retirement plan of last resort. However, for those of you who may find yourself in a situation where you may need to take advantage of this so-called retirement plan of last resort, Jim's going to be talking with Reza Jaghiri. He's the senior publisher of the Reverse Review, which is a monthly publication for reverse mortgage professionals. He's also the CEO of American Advisors Group, which is a reverse mortgage lending company he founded in 2004. You may have seen their television commercials with Fred Thompson. So for those of you who may sort of find yourselves in a tight financial situation in retirement, go ahead and listen in to see if perhaps this reverse mortgage situation might be for you. And for those of you who missed it, last week we did talk about brain health with Dr. Gary Small, who's a professor of psychiatry and the director of UCLA's Longevity Center. Jim talked with him about his book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, about keeping your brain healthy for the rest of your life. This whole program was dedicated to ideas of the costs of not taking care of your mental health and the long-term care costs associated with this. And just a quick note on long-term care insurance. I had a conversation with someone this week that pointed out to me that for those of you who are either government employees or in the military or family members of those people, there is a federal long-term care insurance program available to you. So take a listen to last week's program to learn more about long-term care and to this week's program in case you have a need for reverse mortgages. Until next week, I'm Kathleen Harris for Financial Sense NewsHour.
Joining me on the program is Reza John Geary, a senior publisher of the Reverse Review and CEO of American Advisors. And Reza, as we begin, I wonder, as we get into more technicalities, if you just might take some time here and explain what is a reverse mortgage.
Sure. Reverse mortgage is, in essence, a home equity line of credit with deferred payments. That's the most simple way to describe it. And the loan becomes due once the last borrower on title passes or sells their home. So it's a way for seniors to tap into their home equity to age in place, to live in their homes until they pass or sell their home.
Now, it's my understanding, Reza, that there's different kinds of reverse mortgages, and I wonder if you might take us through maybe some of the more common permutations of these reverse mortgages, because you hear about them, and a lot of times, including your own commercial, that it requires a CD to understand how it works. So take us through the different kind of versions, and let's talk about where a reverse mortgage might apply when it comes to, let's say, somebody planning for retirement or in retirement.
Sure. So there's been, over the last several years, four different kinds of reverse mortgages, all backed by FHA. There's a HECM, we call the reverse mortgage a HECM, home equity conversion mortgage. And there's a HECM fixed product, which is a fixed rate mortgage. And that comes under the fixed standard and fixed saver models. Those are two of the programs. The HECM fixed obviously has a fixed interest rate, like I mentioned, and it's a full draw product. So you need to draw the entire proceeds at the time of originating the loan. And then in addition to those two programs, the HECM fixed standard and saver, the saver is a lower loan to value program. So there's less proceeds to the borrower, but there's also lesser mortgage insurance premium paid to FHA. So it's a lower cost alternative with less proceeds than the HECM fixed standard. And then the additional two products are a HECM adjustable rate mortgage, standard adjustable rate mortgage saver. Again, the difference between the saver and standard are just a lower cost option for the saver in terms of mortgage insurance premium. And the HECM adjustable has an adjustable rate of interest. And that program, you could access a line of credit instead of getting a full draw. And so if you have $100,000 in proceeds, you could access $30,000 right now that incurs interest, and the other $70,000 could stay in a line of credit, which you could have access to in the future if you want to and draw down on it.
Are there programs where you get maybe some initial money up front, but then you get a monthly payment?
So you could build either one of those fixed or the adjustable with 10-year payments. So you could just build it so that payments are coming to you on a monthly basis. That's an option most borrowers do not take. They either usually access the line of credit or the full draw, but that's an option as well that's out there too.
What about, Reza, you get into a situation, let me throw out an example. Husband and wife, married, retired, elderly, one spouse has to be put into a long-term care facility. So now basically what the couple are doing is maintaining two households. The one household that existed when they were both well, and then the second household, which is the long-term care facility. So let's say that strapped for cash, the well spouse takes out a reverse mortgage, and they're using and drawing down those proceeds to take care of long-term care. But let's say that we'll pick on the husband. The husband is in the facility for a couple of years. He passes on. Is there a way for the surviving spouse to either pay that back, or what are the options? Are there some flexibility there where those proceeds are no longer needed?
That's a good question, Jim. So one thing I failed to mention when I was explaining the program, you have to be 62 years of age to qualify. So if there are two borrowers on title, both must be over the age of 62 to qualify. So if you have two borrowers on title that are over the age of 62, and one borrower ends up going into a nursing home or assisted care facility after they've taken out a reverse mortgage, that is okay, as long as the other borrower is still living in the house, which is on title. So once the borrower that's living in the home passes and there's no longer anybody on title living in the home, then at that stage, the reverse mortgage becomes due. So So under your example, it's okay for the husband to be living in the nursing home and the wife to be living in the home, and there's no maturity event on the loan.
In a situation like that, and the reason I want to bring this up, because I have a client that's in a situation like this today where they do have a reverse mortgage, husband's in a retirement home, but the wife, when her husband passes on, she would like to sell the house and move back to where her family is and where her kids are. So in those circumstances, let's just make this simple and say that there was $100,000 that was granted. She uses $36,000. There's maybe $64,000 left. She sells the home. What if there's more equity than the original dollars granted? What happens in this circumstance?
So in that case, the borrower could sell the home at any time they like and pay off the loan. So if she decides to sell off the home, pay the outstanding balance of $34,000 that is due, then at that stage, she takes that additional $66,000, and that's equity to her. Those proceeds go to her, and it's not her obligation to pay anything more than what the outstanding balance of the loan is at that time. So there is the flexibility of selling the home earlier.
How did reverse mortgages come about? Is it a result of low interest rates? We're in situations today where, you know, we're finding a lot more people are spending more time in retirement. They're living longer. So they're running into these very type cases where you may get Alzheimer's or some kind of debilitating illness where long-term care is needed. Can you give me a little bit of history, how this came about? Because it seems to be a prominent option for many seniors today, because I just judge that by the number of commercials I see regarding it.
Sure. So the program has been around in terms of being backed by FHA since 1989, and it didn't really start gaining momentum till, you know, mid 2000s, 2003, 4, 5, when you really started seeing the volume increase and there be adoption from the market. But the issue we're facing right now is we have a lot of seniors that their primary asset is their home equity. And they don't have much in savings, and they're living on fixed income. And so when you're in that situation where you're living on fixed income and you don't have substantial savings, if there is a life event that comes up that demands access to cash, or if you're running negative cash flow each month, so if you have $1,500 of fixed income coming in, but your expenses are $1,700, and you're making a mortgage payment on it, what we call a forward mortgage, a conventional mortgage, then at that stage, you don't have many options but for to sell your home and downsize or rent. So that's when the reverse mortgage comes in place, and that's what it was designed for, to allow the senior to access that equity and to be able to live in their house for their remaining years and go into hopefully a positive cash flow scenario or have some cash sitting in the bank through the proceeds of the reverse mortgage. And as we have the demographic in this country, you know, we have a lot more people aging and a lot of baby boomers right now hitting their retirement years. And the fact that we're having Social Security issues, Medicare issues as a country, this really helps take off the stress and allows people to use their own assets to take care of themselves in their remaining years instead of having to borrow from their kids, be in the bad situation of having to downsize when they're in their 70s or move out of their home or be on the government's dime, so to speak.
Reza, do you find there's a common characteristic? I know I live here in California where the average duration of somebody living in a home is 3 to 5 years and they're moving on someplace else. We have relatives back east. People tend to stay in the same house over a longer period of time. Do you find there's any differentiation between, let's say, age groups or regions of the country regarding reverse mortgages?
The program is actually pretty conservative. The average loan to value is about 60%, and the average borrower age is about 71 years of age right now. Younger borrowers are accessing reverse mortgages more commonly as time goes on because we have more baby boomers hitting the threshold age that need to access their home equity. But in terms of where we see penetration of reverse mortgages, it's consistent with senior population in states. So California, New York, Texas, Florida, the more intuitive states, there's higher volumes of reverse mortgages. But besides that, we don't see any other unique stats in terms of where reverse mortgages are being originated or utilized.
What is the difference between a company like yours and others out there? I mean, I know, for example, if I was a homeowner and I was wanting to, let's say, buy a home, I would shop the marketplace, maybe find a mortgage broker. Maybe I have a relationship with an existing banker. What is the difference between you guys?
Anybody that currently originates a reverse mortgage needs to be approved by FHA. And there's lenders out there, there's brokers out there, and there's state-exempt banks that all originate reverse mortgages. difference with AAG, one big difference we have is we are exclusively a reverse mortgage lender. That's the only product we originate. There's many players out there that originate conventional mortgages as well, too. So this is our core focus, it's our expertise. Besides that, there's different business models. Some people have loan officers that sit down with customers face-to-face. Some have a centralized call center. We operate under a call center model we think is the most efficient. And as you know, we advertise on television with Senator Fred Thompson primarily. And it's been a great way for us to help a lot of seniors in the country. We do business in 47 states. Some companies have a lot more of a regional focus. We're kind of nationwide because of our centralized and direct-to-consumer model.
I can think of a number of reasons. You mentioned one of them, which is a lot of seniors find themselves in retirement where their main asset is locked up in the equity of their home. They run into unexpected medical costs. Maybe they've run up some credit card bills because they're on fixed income, maybe home repairs. Just look at some of the natural weather disasters we've seen, or just simply looking for another means to tap another source of income. Let's say they're on a fixed pension or annuity. Can you think of, in terms of providing a solution, why would an individual consider a reverse mortgage as an option? In other words, why not just maybe sell the home, downsize, take your equity, get yourself in another situation? Why a reverse mortgage?
Good question, Jim. There's about 20 million eligible seniors that would potentially qualify for a reverse mortgage and own their home and have substantial equity that could be able to utilize this. Out of those 20 million, about 70% of them own their home free and clear. The other 30% have liens on the property. And the 30% that have liens on their property, one reason a lot of times we see they're utilizing the reverse mortgage is, I'll give you an example. There's a 71-year-old senior widow living in a $200,000 home, and they have a $100,000 mortgage. And they're living on $1,500 of fixed income, like I mentioned earlier, and they have $1,700 of expenses and very minimal savings. Well, that senior has $100,000 of equity, and they're running cash flow negative. So an option that you recommended, that you said is an option, is to sell their home and downsize or rent. So instead of living in a $200,000 home, go purchase a $100,000 home. That is a very tough thing for many seniors that have lived in their homes for 20, 30 years or more, and it's tough to be displaced and have to go downsize, especially in your retirement years. The option of refinancing and potentially pulling some money out of your house under a conventional or forward mortgage typically is not a viable option because most seniors living on fixed income have a hard time qualifying, especially under really tight credit markets as we're facing today. So although it is an option to sell the home and downsize, it's typically not a preferred option for many seniors. So instead, they utilize a reverse mortgage, and under my scenario where they were $200 cash flow negative, they access $120,000 from a reverse mortgage in this example, and the $100,000 has to be paid off, the existing lien. They have $20,000 left over that could sit in their bank account for emergencies like you mentioned, medical expenses, home repairs. And then the key thing here is they were paying, let's say, a $600 mortgage payment prior to getting the reverse mortgage. That mortgage payment is eliminated. So instead of being $200 cash flow negative under my example, they're $400 cash flow positive after paying off their existing mortgage. So you took somebody that was in a cash flow negative situation with minimal savings, you put $20,000 in their bank account, you gave them $400 of positive cash flow, and now they can live the rest of their years in that home comfortably without having to worry about a mortgage payment and losing the house. Now, I must mention, they still need to maintain their taxes and insurance. They must pay their property tax and their homeowner's insurance to be complying with the covenants of the loan.
I mean, this all sounds pretty good, Reza. What are some of the drawbacks to a reverse mortgage? And what are some of the things that, let's say, a potential customer should be asking? In other words, in addition to the drawbacks, we've heard there's been scandals in this area. What should they be on the lookout for?
So, Jim, every borrower, it's mandated by HUD, by FHA. If they're going to borrow and get into a reverse mortgage, they need to go through mandatory counseling. We suggest and we ensure the borrower goes through counseling. And that's a very great safeguard, which allows them to understand the alternative options they have and know exactly what kind of financial transaction they're getting into. So we're big proponents of counseling, and we think that FHA should continue mandating this, and we should keep bettering the counseling process. With that said, there's always going to be unscrupulous people in industries. So once in a while, you'll have somebody that gets into a reverse mortgage and their children, you know, utilize the proceeds inappropriately and the person was in a sound mind. Those things do happen. We don't see an abnormally high incidence of that, but everybody should be aware and make sure that through the counseling process, they hopefully vet the lender they're working with and make sure that the program is appropriate for them. In addition to counseling, some of the critiques about the reverse mortgage program historically have been, and most recently actually, that if a borrower is not paying, is delinquent on their tax and insurance, they could potentially be foreclosed on and lose their home. That is a correct statement. And back when the program was developed in 88 or 89, these things were not thought of properly. And the product needs to evolve. And we're working right now with FHA to solve that tax and insurance problem, either through a set-aside or reserve to make sure people have the money to pay for their tax and insurance, or through a light underwrite or financial assessments to make sure we spot issues up front and make sure people have the cash flow after they get the reverse mortgage to be able to maintain their tax and insurance. So in addition to the tax and insurance issue, there's been historical comments made about this being a very expensive program. We don't feel that it's too expensive. We always say expensive compared to what? And a lot of that critique has been pointed towards the fact that there's a mortgage insurance premium paid to FHA. That FHA mortgage insurance premium is an important safeguard for the consumer so that it allows this program to be non-recourse. So if the home value when the loan becomes due, when the borrower passes, is lesser than the loan amount, the heirs in estate aren't responsible for that, what we call crossover, that balance. In addition, if a borrower borrows a line of credit from a lender and the lender happens to go under and not be able to pay the entire proceeds to the borrower when they want them, FHA steps in and ensures that the borrower will get those proceeds. That's part of the reason that the borrower pays the mortgage insurance premium to FHA. And it also keeps the rates at a very competitive level as well, too.
Rachel, let me just ask you a question. You said that somebody considering a reverse mortgage must go through counseling. Tell me a little bit about that counseling. What is covered in this counseling? Is it to maybe inform the potential client what they're doing, how it works, their responsibilities? Is it appropriate? Tell me a little bit more about that counseling. Who's involved? Who provides it?
Counseling is provided by a third-party counselor, which has to be approved by FHA. So they go through testing and certification requirements. So the third-party counselors, their job is to ensure the borrower understands exactly how the reverse mortgage works, what their options and alternatives are. And they also do an assessment for the borrower of what they're looking like from a cash flow standpoint, what their assets are, what their balance sheet looks like, their income looks like, and helps them through what their situation would look like post-transaction and if it's the right choice for them. So it's a pretty comprehensive process, and it helps the borrower decipher if this is the proper channel and product for them. And for many cases, it's not. It's not for everybody. But this is a good tool in there that ensures an objective third party helps guide the borrower through that process.
And if you were to categorize, Reza, who this is really not appropriate for, is there anything that stands out, a type of group, a type of individual, a type of circumstance where this really doesn't apply?
Sure. So one thing that comes to mind right off the bat is somebody that cannot maintain their obligations like upkeeping the house and paying their tax and insurance. If they're really truly that cash tight after they get the reverse mortgage, they're not a good fit for this program. So they're better off just selling the house and downsizing. In addition, I mentioned earlier that 70% of our demographic owns their homes free and clear, approximately. More and more so, as baby boomers hit the retirement age, they're looking at things like the reverse mortgage to utilize home equity as part of retirement planning. It's becoming more and more important, especially as pensions have been hit, savings have been hit, so on and so forth. So it could also be used for a retirement planning tool. So, you know, you could have a line of credit available for someone that wants to access cash, and if they have other investments, not have to displace them, so on and so forth. But under that scenario, if someone really has a lot of access to cash and heavy income, a lot of times a reverse mortgage is not the right choice. Why accumulate interest on your home equity when you already have other sources of cash and no need for cash? So if somebody really does have the proper assets and cash flow, a reverse mortgage may not make sense for them. Also, finally, because of the cost, the mortgage insurance premium and the origination fees, which may or may not be waived nowadays, the cost of getting into a reverse mortgage, anyone that plans on selling their home within a year or two, we think it's not the right option for them.
Reza, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about AAG, do you have a website you'd like to give out where they can find out and get information?
Sure. Our website is www.aagreverse.com. And we'd be more than happy if whoever wants to come online and put in their information, we'll send them an informational DVD and brochure and testimonials with Senator Fred Thompson on the DVD to help guide them through the process and see if it's the right program for them.
All right. And you also have a toll-free number, which is 800-850-1356. Reza, I'd like to thank you for joining us here in Lifetime Income, because this is a subject that has come up more frequently here on the program. We've had a lot of requests to cover this topic. I want to thank you for joining us, and all the best to you, sir.
Thanks for having us.
On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for listening to this week's Lifetime Income.
Can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.